Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones LCG podcast. Originally founded in 2010 as Two Champs and a Chump, we decided to rebrand when the game relaunched in the second edition. A huge thank you goes out to Fantasy Flight Games and George R. R. Martin for this game and world we love, and of course to my co-hosts and you, the listeners. Please, if you enjoy the show, leave us a review on iTunes or your platform of choice, comment on our Facebook threads, or even better, support us on Patreon. We love turning that kind of support back into the community. This is Season 10 of the White Book Podcast. Welcome back to Props and Slops this week on episode 433 of The White Book. I'm Will, joined by my compatriots.
I'm Aaron.
I'm Roy.
Yes! We nailed it, guys. It only took us 433 episodes.
So the audio is going to get messed up. We're going to have to re-record and we're going to mess up.
Oh, fact. It's going to be terrible.
It's been a long while since the audio got unsalvageable and couldn't be used, at least an episode that I've been involved in. So
it has, but now you guys have me terrified. Find the largest wooden object you can right now and knock on it for good luck.
I mean, knocking with a toe counts as knocking, right?
Yeah. I think. I would count it.
Okay, so let's start with stuff I've seen nothing, but you guys have watched. You want a prop and or slop from the watch category?
Sure. I'll go ahead and kick it off since mine's at the top of the list here, and the second item is kind of a sub-item of this one anyway. I am going to prop Peacock, despite the iconic yet also unfortunate name. This is NBC Universal's entry into the streaming wars of 2020, and it's the last of the major companies to enter the arena now. And, like, frankly, I actually have to say I think it's my favorite of the new streaming services to have launched in the last year-ish. At least on Xbox, which is where I've been accessing it for the most part, though I did a little bit on my phone, but mainly on Xbox. The interface is just really slick and seems just much smoother to move around and more intuitive to do the things I want to do than other ones I've been in lately. I'm looking at you, HBO Max, or like Pluto or something like that. I really like combining both a good on-demand selection with the always-on channels. I mean, sure, it's not the same as literally like tuning into HGTV or the History Channel or, you know, whatever on satellite. But if you just want some background noise, you know, while you're making dinner or folding laundry or something, it's hard to beat 24/7 Saturday Night Live reruns. There's a bunch of others on there as well. There's a 24/7 Today channel and NBC News, and I think one's Office reruns, and I think Sky TV's on there. There's a bunch of EPL League soccer matches, that sort of thing. So yeah, overall, I really like that. Plus the pricing scheme, I think, is much more attractive than some other stuff. So you get access to, I think it's like 3/4-ish of all their content for free with ads, just like regular television, basically. Or they have a paid plan starting at $4.99, I think, $4.95.
That's free to Comcast subscribers, by the way.
Get
everything with ads. It's free to Comcast
subscribers. Nice.
Subscribers and Cox.
Yeah, so you get everything with a few ads, which is not a bad price. Or you can go adless for, I think it's $9.95 or whatever. So the price points are much more reasonable to me than other recent services. Again, looking at you, HBO Max.
Yeah, it definitely puts HBO Max to shame, both on its initial offerings, its pricing structure, which I guess the best way to think about it to me is it's old school Hulu. Mm-hmm. So Hulu back when I used it more regularly, which is, you know, freemium. And I do agree with you, Will, that the access to like being able to watch, because, you know, Al and I cut the cord. Comcast forces us to pay for some channels. I don't even know what channels we have, but we don't even have the TV box hooked up. But it is nice to just, particularly when I'm using Peacock on my phone, to be able to like watch like 15 minutes of news or whatever, and then like watch what I'm going to watch is pretty good. I like that. I will say, I think the $4.99 to get access to everything with ads is kind of a cash grab. And the fact that they're willing to give it away as a nominal thing to basically anyone mildly in the Comcast world kind of tells you that it's kind of a joke.
Don't they own Comcast?
They do, yes. But the fact that they're just willing to give it away to me with my Comcast internet package, you know, tells me that it's not worth that much to them, right? Because they don't give you the ad-free version with my overpriced Comcast plan. They give me the, oh, sure. And a lot of the good stuff, like the good shit, like, is behind the paywall. Right. I mean, the biggest one, of course, is Law & Order, which is, like, not streaming anywhere. Like, I'm talking about, like, not Sex Detectives, not none of that new bullshit. I'm talking about old school 80s and 90s Law & Order, the stuff that the three of us grew up on, that bullshit. Yeah. That's behind the paywall. And they don't actually even have, my number one, I think the service is good. We're going to use it. It was briefly on the PS4 today, but it was removed for some reason from the PS4.
Oh.
But I used it for a while, and it was good. I used it for about a break between in work. I used it for a couple hours, and it was good. Like, it streamed very smoothly. It wasn't super ad-y. Like Hulu is these days. It feels like every 5 seconds, Hulu. It's like watching actual television on Hulu. So the ads were kind of reasonably spaced out. I really enjoyed the service. I also agree with you that it's better than HBO Max. I don't think it's better than Disney Plus, even though it probably has more content. But
if Disney Plus had live channels, if I could just tune in and zone out to like old sitcoms or something on there, I would probably give the edge back to Disney Plus. But I like having both integrated.
That's fair. It's more that what Peacock is going for is it has better TV shows, except for the big one of The Simpsons on Disney Plus. Like Disney Plus has billions of hours of The Simpsons that you can just lose yourself in, which I think is a huge value. Like literally, Disney Plus is worth it just for the 10 good seasons of The Simpsons alone. Yeah.
I mean, if they just had a Simpsons 24/7 channel that saved me the effort of even like having to go browse to an episode and pick something to watch, that would be pretty sweet.
The problem with that, Will, is you might get stuck with some of the newer episodes, which I would not be interested in. When we want to watch it, we just like pick a good season and we press play and let it run. Yeah. I think it's definitely probably my second favorite of the more recent streaming services. Definitely miles ahead of HBO Max, which is starting to get some more content. I would imagine if all the DC Universe stuff is folded into it by the end of the year.
Yeah.
And I'm happy that, you know, to have access to HBO Max, but it's definitely not something I would go out of my way for, which I think Peacock is definitely worth putting on your phone, even if you're not a subscriber, to occasionally watch some stuff. And there's some really good deep cuts, like Murder, She Wrote is on there.
Yeah.
It's a thing I'm looking forward to revisiting. Some other stuff.
Just to add to that, and you're welcome to list more of these, but just the route you're headed down, I think, is one of the other big pluses about Peacock is I feel like their library of older content is much deeper than, frankly, any of the other services I've tinkered around with. They've got the older Law and Order, like you mentioned, Murder, She Wrote, heck, Punky Brewster, The Munsters, a bunch of old Hitchcock stuff. Like they seem to have really worked on adding a lot more back catalog.
Yeah, definitely a lot of the old NBC sitcoms. I hope we also see some of the old, like, one-hour dramas that I grew up with, like L.A. Law, like the and stuff like that. That were like big NBC stuff. I'm kind of excited. I am a sucker for late 70s, 80s, and 90s hour dramas. I was very cool in middle school and high school watching a lot of TV Land and old TV shows. I was very, very cool. So
back when TV Land was that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, not now it's like King of Queens or something. Everybody loves Raymond.
Yeah. You know, a person who considered one of his best accomplishments in high school to have watched every single episode of MASH twice. you know, in a world before DVDs or before you could really easily download stuff, I'm excited for that kind of thing. I hope they get some, because NBC has some real bangers throughout its history that I hope end up entirely on the platform. And it shows that Comcast is willing to put it on there, which I think is a good sign for its health. I think Peacock's a good addition. We'll see. Like, I'm less excited. I know you're going to be talking about Brave New World in a little bit. I'm less excited for the original programming, but I am excited for it as a resource for just the older shows. So I would definitely prop it with the slop that it needs to get fully on the PlayStation 4 sooner rather than later.
Yeah. I guess Aaron is still out of the loop on that. You keep getting screwed on Roku stuff, right?
Fire TV. Apparently Bezos doesn't play well with others.
Surprise, surprise.
Who'd have thought?
Yeah. Well, whatever.
Disney paid him enough though, right? Because Disney on?
Disney is there. Disney was added like the night of or something, like at launch. It was ridiculous. But yeah, I can't watch HBO Max and I can't watch Peacock, so I'm just gonna ignore them. I mean, like, what am I gonna do? I'm not buying a new TV for this.
Right.
Fair.
Eventually they'll come up with a deal or they won't, and I just won't have access to those. Like,
and the Switch doesn't have any TV stuff on it, right?
It has Hulu, doesn't it?
Sure, whatever. I have Hulu. I mean, Hulu's already on my TV. It wouldn't super matter. I'm not docking the Switch and setting it up for that. I just don't care enough. Like, if I won't get cable, if it's not easy to watch, I'm at a point where, like, I'm not going to watch it. I love Brave New World. I've caught Brave New World multiple times. Like, I think it's an excellent book, and I think it does a better job with human nature, if not necessarily with authority, than 1984 does. I would love to watch that show. But I'm not going out of my way. Like, there's just so much stuff to watch. Like, that I'm past struggling for things.
Oh, that is totally true, that there's so much stuff to watch. I can't hardly keep up with everything that I wish I could. But I am glad I've started Brave New World. I will tentatively prop it since I am not done with it yet. I'm almost exactly halfway. I'm in the middle of the fifth episode out of 9, I think. So pretty darn close. But I was kind of intrigued because Grant Morrison was involved in the adaptation. And
was he?
Yes. He gets like top billing in this, just about. And I am very intrigued. I think having to play ball with a bigger team maybe reined in some of his excesses, but still kept some of his smarter ideas. Now, I mean, I can't say for dead certain, you know, what tweaks are whose idea or whatever, but there have been some good tweaks. There's a couple like gender swaps of characters, which are whatever, no biggie either way. But there is an addition of an AI system, like society-wide, you know, contact lens implant kind of thing, that adds a nice layer onto things. And of course, wouldn't have been anything that Huxley, right? Yeah, that
Huxley wrote it in like the, I believe, the early 30s. Yeah. So like anything you were even remotely considering as modern is not for that, right? Like it's pre-World War II.
Frankly, I mean, there's still a lot of other stuff that...
Oh, he just nails stuff because he's a genius, right? Yeah. But like... but
he's also high as shit.
Yeah, also well, high as shit.
No wonder Morrison was involved.
But he figured out a lot of where technology would make sense as a place to go. But most of that didn't exist. It was his imagination.
Yeah. So I highly recommend it. I'm enjoying it. And it's pretty entertaining to see the show headlined by Han Solo, Lady Sybil Crawley, and Viserys Targaryen.
Cool, cool.
Not Han Solo, and I'd really appreciate it if you didn't call him that.
that's fair.
Well, his name's Han, so that's, you know. Yeah. Solo is just...
the deepest of cuts.
Right. In the meantime, Brave New World is excellent, and people should read it.
Yeah, definitely.
Also, the first chapter is very, very weird and difficult. So if you do decide to read it, be forewarned that the rest of the novel will not work like the first chapter. The first chapter is going to do all the world building stuff, like all up front, so it can get to the plot.
Well, I should definitely travel back in time through the quantum realm to my teenage high school self and tell him that. Because I never made it past the first chapter of Brave New World in high school, so
that's why I specifically tell my students. I do a mini dystopian text unit, and it's one of the choices. And I'm like, this is my favorite of the books, but you're gonna have to suffer through chapter one. You'll like the rest. Chapter one is literally just like a tour of how the world works, and it doesn't relate. Like, it'll be referenced, right? Like, you need to know how the world works, but like, it's not plot. It's world building. Just get it. Right?
Right. Yeah.
There was a rumor, and I don't know if it was confirmed, that Grant Morrison was heading up a new comic line or something.
He's headed up like six new comic lines through his history.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
No, but I think like it's like NBC Universal is starting the comic line.
Yeah. Now that you say that, I do think I read something about that recently.
Yeah, let's take a look. Google.
Yeah.
Tells
me. UCP.
Nothing useful. Peacock's Brave New World.
Published by Boom.
Oh, it's with through Boom. At least not okay. Dynamite.
I think so.
Well, yeah. Well, Dynamite. Let's slop Dynamite already, immediately. They're in bed with Comicsgate, and Comicsgate are the worst people.
Definitely, pick a gate, pick a modern day gate. Like it's hard to pick between Comicsgate and Gamersgate, Glazer. Like why choose? They both are.
There's a lot of
they're ultimately the same people, right? Like they might think they're different people, but they're really just the same people. They're the same people. Harassing people in different mediums, being disgusting. So slops to them.
Full agreement with Glazer there. The one thing you could say is that the origins of Comicsgate are much clearer and easier to understand than the origins of Gamersgate. If you actually were there at the time and followed the immediate origins of Gamersgate, which will still never make any sense to me. Ever about how the specific incident that led to Gamersgate became literally one of the things that helped elect the current president of the United States.
Ugh.
What a world we live in.
All right. In the meantime, let's move on. What's cursed? Besides the world we live in.
Yes, besides the world we live in, is a new YA-inspired CW style show, I guess you could say, on Netflix, which, as longtime listeners of Props and Slops and the White Book should know, is my jam and my wife's jam. Weirdly, it is by Frank Miller and is based on a comic book that Frank Miller did.
I did not realize that.
Which Alan Googled about two episodes into us watching the first four or five episodes of it. After she said that, you can kind of see the Millerisms, but because, like, the thing, I'm going to prop the show, let's be clear, and I'll talk a little bit about the setup. It is a retelling of Arthurian legend, which is another thing that both Al and I enjoy. It's basically Arthurian legend reinterpreted through somebody who bought YA novels 101. Like, every beat, particularly in the pilot, is like every beat you would expect from like a YA novel of Hunger Games, Twilight, all that kind of storytelling. And it's kind of, that's very charming to me. It's like on the noseness and tropiness is quite charming to me. Other people's mileage may vary. It expands a little bit, becomes a little bit different, like a lot of these kind of shows once it gets going, but it's still very inspired by that. But the fact that Miller is working within that genre and doing it in a really unironic way limits a lot of the Millerian excesses. So you start seeing like some of the strengths of Miller as a storyteller. The violence is like weirdly on point, but still constrained. The female characters have depth. There's no nonsensical nudity. It's weird. It's definitely weird. But Frank Miller does a lot of the like scene transition art. Like, one of the cool things about the show is when they fade in and out of scenes, a lot of them like have these cool art fades that are done by Miller. And they're really well done. So yeah, it's surprising because, again, Glazer knows this well, but like, I have not engaged with the Frank Miller work of art since Sin City, like the movie Sin City. Yeah. I guess it's not true. I read the first Dark Knight sequel, which I guess came out after Sin City, the movie.
Oh boy.
That was those are the two last Frank Miller things. I'm not an appreciator of the goddamn Batman.
That
was All-Star Knight Batman, thing. Yes, and Robin.
That was All-Star Batman and Robin, which was amazingly bad.
Oh, unbelievably so. I'm still working in a comic book store when that came out. So it was like close to two decades ago. 15 years ago, actually. So I was surprised that I enjoyed it so much after Ala told me that it was by Frank Miller. But I would definitely recommend it. If you are someone who has been following my recommendations, which are frequently these kinds of shows, you will continue to like it. If you like The Order, you'll like Cursed. If you like that kind of stuff, you'll like it. It's light, goofy, but it's got fun, forward, moving action and, you know, characters you can engage with. And it's just enjoyable. Takes itself with the right amount of seriousness, which is definitely not too much. And it's a cool sword.
Well, I think mostly you've pretty well sold me on it. How many episodes is that?
It's like 10. It's the normal like Netflix order.
Okay. Well, so I'm gonna have to give that a try.
Let's move on to Reed. What's King's Blood?
I had mentioned a couple of Props and Slops back that I was finally working on tackling a fantasy series I'd started some years ago and started it over, Daniel Abraham's Dagger and Coin series. There we go. I had to stop and think of the series name. So I was rereading the first book, The Dragon's Path, then. King's Blood is the second book. And I just wrapped it up last week and have moved on to the third. So I think at this point I'm still propping things overall. It's interesting. It's interesting to see. I mean, we're a spoiler for full show, right? So it's interesting to see that an unexpected main character death can still hit me, or at least one that I still expected to not actually be a death. I mean, to put this in context, it's a character who winds up in a lot of ways, the same situation as Eddard Stark. And even though, you know, at this point, the character should be executed in the real world, you're used to the fantasy tropes that, oh, something's going to happen. He's going to get out of this and, you know, be exiled or something or whatever. And then, no, he just dies.
Oh, that happens in this one? I thought that happened in the first one.
No, it happened in this one, at the end of this one. Okay. So,
can we be super spoiler?
Yeah. Here? Yeah. Okay. I think so. Folks know that we do that.
So, okay. This is the one where, okay. So the guy, the general gets executed, right?
Yeah. He tries to kill, the regent, the character that I'm fascinated and repulsed by. As we
Gender.
Watch, yeah. As we watch from, like, he is an actual POV chapter. And I had said when I read the first book years ago that I was fascinated that it really seemed by the end of that first book that one of our POV characters was actually going to be, like, one of or possibly the main villain of the series. And here by the end of this book, in kind of the standard fantasy trope, he would be, you know, learning and growing and people coming to respect him. And no, due to his character flaws, you just continue watching him sliding it into pure villainy.
Yeah. One of the things that is cool, I've read the first three books of this and part of the fourth. Well, it is that, like, Gender is the villain and he gets POV chapters that treat him like he's the hero.
Yeah.
Of those. So it does a good job of, like, showing you his internal logic and not the kind of, like, one step removed where it's like, obviously the narrative is telling you that the narrative and the narration is telling you that he's the villain. It's, you know, very closely embedded and saying that, you know, like, of giving you his point of view as he does these things that are extremely awful. And then there's, you know, like, five other POVs that show you, like, everything this guy's doing is terrible. Yeah. It is one of the more interesting things about the series. I forget, this is, I'm trying to be careful to make sure I don't spoil you.
Right.
Like, where does Marcus end up in the end of this one?
At the end of this one, the buddy of his that I really liked their rapport, it reminded me of Zoe and Mal.
Han Solo and Chewbacca. Or Han Solo and Chewbacca.
Yeah. But you only ever really get one half of that conversation, so the repartee is not quite as entertaining. Anyway, yeah, Haim finally betrays him and says, you know, his Marcus had kept asking him for evidently years, it seems at this point, like, hey, I'm going to make this bad decision. Is today the day you, overthrow me and take the company? And Yharnam finally says, sir, today's that day.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah, I think by the very end of the novel, like, that might have only been about 80% through. I think by the very end, he's been rescued by Kit.
Right. He's like ditched in a cage or something, and Kit rescues him, and then they go off and they're like, "We're gonna fight the villains."
Right. Yeah, and so now more has been explained about this kind of magical, possibly weapon, possibly goddess, not sure, who knows, the righteous servant, as it was. And so the first book plays up a lot that they claim to know what's true and what isn't, but it was hinted that something was off, and that was really not quite what they were doing. So at this point, I forget now, though, if that is in the second book or if it's in the first few chapters of the third book that I've already read, where Kit has explained more that it really only measures certainty. It may be, like, true or not in an objective sense. It's just whether you believe it to be true or not, which complicates things.
Yeah. I found a lot in large swaths of the Tyrant's Law to be really boring. So I jumped off it. One of the main characters, who actually liked the character a lot, Citrin, I think that's how you pronounce her name.
Maybe. I've liked her a lot so far.
She's a banker, and
that's Will's favorite character.
I know. I'm sorry, Will.
I like her a lot. She is probably my favorite character, but I do like Marcus a lot too.
Yeah, I mean, all the characters.
Even Clara has really grown on me.
Yeah, Clara is one of the better characters in the second book. And the third book, if I remember right, she's also pretty interesting. But the banking stuff is just too much for me. Like, as it moves more and more into, like, the prominence as, like, rather than her just being a banker, but the plot starts revolving around banker stuff more, I'm just like, oh my God, this is really dull. I can't do it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, your mileage will probably be much further than mine will. But...
We'll see how it goes. I mean, that stuff kind of made sense in the first book, right? They're kind of setting all the gears in motion, and you start with something kind of lower stakes high stakes for her as a character, but lower stakes in the grand scheme of the world with her trying her long con to set up her own bank and stuff. But then you kind of expect everything to move past that. So... We'll see, I guess, once I get further into it, if it feels like it's delving too much into that nitty gritty.
Yeah, you definitely feel sometimes like Daniel Abraham really read a bunch of books about banking and was like, oh man, I'm going to put this in my fantasy novel.
Like, this is brilliant.
Or he secretly Will Lentz.
I have more faith in that name,
the pseudonym. Will's like, I'm just gonna write it in.
Yep. Finally, I can make the banker a hero. We've got two things to our name. It's a Wonderful Life and the Dagger and Coin series.
I mean, she is definitely one of the heroines, so like unironically, she is definitely one of the good guys, at least in the as far as I read in the series.
So. I was going to say, as far as I can tell so far, it has definitely seemed that way. And I did legitimately get very worried at the point in the second book. She's hiding out through some circumstances with Gator, the growing villain. And the two kind of start bonding and connecting, and they wind up sleeping together and so on. And I was really worried about the direction this was going to go. But then Citrin quickly like sees through his bullshit when she sees how he actually acts when he's in a position of power. And she basically says, yeah, I'm out. This is proven. This guy is seriously messed up. I'm gone. So I was happy about that. But
it's not on the list. I just want to quickly slop something that I really, really like. I want to slop the Hickmanette X-Men.
Oh yeah.
Between, like, it had basically lost all narrative momentum before the coronavirus, but like, given how little is happening right now, as far as like media anyway, I don't think that the extreme deconstruction of it can actually like work as a narrative, and I think the entire line is kind of falling apart, and it makes me really sad.
This is Hickman's X-Men run.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, which means the whole X line right now, right? Like, because it's all based on his vision, but like, just there's no narrative momentum to anything, and it was super deconstructed and disconnected to begin with. Which was one thing when, like, there was a world that was ongoing. But now I think it's just bad, and, like, there needs to be a serious reappraisal of how it's being told and what's being done with it. So I hope Marvel does that.
Unlikely. Just sounds like every Jonathan Hickman thing I've ever read, from bits of his Avengers, for bits of his Fantastic Four, to Secret War, where it's like lots of cool ideas, no narrative momentum, lots of hand waving. It ends.
I really, really, really loved Secret Wars. Like, I really liked Time Runs Out. I didn't like Infinity. Like, I think his Fantastic Four run is probably my favorite run of Marvel Comics ever.
Wow.
I agree. Yeah. Well, I also really, really love Fantastic Four. Like, number two is probably Wade's run. So, but it's... I do not usually find that with Hickman. And I have some faith that this was going somewhere good. I just wish they would stop, like if they kept this to like a couple books and then were like, all right, we're just going to keep the line small for now and rebuild, everything would have worked better than if they were like, here's eight books and they're all telling their own individual stories within this and nothing can have any momentum until we're ready for the next big event. Like, It's the way comics in the modern day tell their stories that I have a problem with as much as anything else. Nothing is allowed to develop organically without an event. So a lot of the stuff that's meant to build doesn't. It spins plates until the next event allows a giant like lurch of progression, and then it's a like stop and spin plates again until the next event. And I don't, like, it's hard for me to blame Hickman for that, because that's every comic event since at least Civil War.
Before, but yeah. I mean, and Marvel since New Avengers.
Right. Okay, so since New Avengers, that's fair.
That's like...
So since December.
6 years. Right.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Since in the 21st century, it's how Marvel's operated.
Right. So I think that is ultimately my problem. But... I come more or less to terms with it, except that I don't like, I think it works especially poorly during a pandemic.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, Hickman is pretty notorious, even by, I think, people who are more Hickman fans, for being like taking the decompressed style of storytelling to kind of an extreme where things are very slow and spread out over a long period of time. I mean, you could just point to his extended run on the three big non-mutant Marvel books, right? Like, the story he wanted to tell stretched from Fantastic Four into the Avengers, the several Avengers events he was the showrunner for, and then Secret Wars. Like,
that, but
5 years of
sure. I don't think that's how that worked, though. Like, I've gone back and read his Avengers run. Like, it's entirely possible I'm wrong, but Infinity just sounds like an editorial mandate. Like, if you go back and read, like, the mini events into Avengers, like, he seemed to really want to do Time Runs Out, and he seemed to really want to do Secret Wars. But a lot of the, like, stuff that led up to that, like, he started building it, like, right at the start of his run, and then, like, there was a complete stop where, like, he set up, like, all these other events. And I don't think were his events. I think they were just like, well, it's been a year and we need a tentpole event. And well, you're the Avengers, right?
Well,
now.
You know,
you
there was a big push for that.
Infinity War is coming out soon. So we need a Thanos event. Yeah. No,
right.
Yeah. No, I mean, that, there's definitely some truth to that. But I think Hickman, I think the core, I mean, also if you read Secret War, it like dispenses with a lot of the work that was done to set it up with, set it up in the first couple of issues, including work that Hickman himself had done to set up Secret Wars, which is one of the reasons why I kind of like Secret Wars kind of never really like sat well in my taste level.
Secret Wars should have never been an Avengers. Like, building it out of an Avengers run doesn't make any sense, because it was like, I don't feel like Hickman ever had any great interest in the Avengers as even a concept. Like, he was just trying to get to a Fantastic Four story, right?
Like, definitely. But he was on, like, Avengers for a long time.
Oh, for a really long time. But, like, he started out with... He starts out with Fantastic Four years. It everything builds. There's not a ton of filler. There's a little filler. There's
2 years,
filler
and everything. 3 years.
Because there was Fantastic Four, then it canceled, relaunched as FF, and then went back to Fantastic Four.
Let me see. He did Fantastic Four 570 through 588, and then 600 to 611 from Dark Reign. Holy crap! All the way through. Yeah, a long time. And then he did Avengers from...
It sounds like 4 years of Fantastic Four.
Yeah, 4 years of Fantastic Four, and then it looks like 3 years
but of Avengers? So much longer, doesn't it? Because like Fantastic Four was stories that made sense and had momentum, while Avengers was like this giant meandering thing that was like, well, let's end it by telling a story about that Fantastic Four.
Well, no, he came onto Avengers in 2013, and what, Secret Wars was 2016,
I thought.
15?
2 years.
Of course, it doesn't have, this doesn't have the year for Secret Wars, but I can click on it and find out. 2015, yeah. So he was there for 2 years. He was on Avengers, but he was on both Avengers books and multiple
spinoffs.
So that's probably another reason why it feels what, right? Because he was writing both Avengers books. So that's really 4 years worth of comics.
So about the same amount, except one had narrative momentum and one didn't.
That's fair.
It's just, you know, one had to be the temple of the line, while in Fantastic Four, he had to do kind of whatever he wanted, right? Like, no one's ever, like, you don't write Fantastic Four and you're like, stop, you have to have this event. You can't just tell your Fantastic Four story.
Not in the 21st century, certainly. There was a time when they would do that.
Right. But I feel like it's really hard to have a long, good Avengers run because you're going to be asked to do that multiple stop to tell event.
I mean, if we're being brutally honest, like, there has not been that many good long Avengers runs. 20 years? Oh, no. I mean, you could go back to the old days, right?
Like, well, I really liked Uncanny Avengers, right? Uncanny was very, very good. That's the Remender one.
I'm not a Rick Remender person, so.
It's a good series.
Sure. The Al Ewing stuff, like, I mean, I don't read comics regularly.
Really love the Al Ewing stuff, but like, I don't even, that's that it 20 years ago or 30 years ago, that would have been called Champions or something, right?
Well, he's now on the main Avengers book.
Probably wouldn't have been Champions, but that's a different issue. He's
currently writing the main Avengers book, so, or one of them.
Yeah. I read some of that. It was reasonably fun. I don't know. They seem to really be pushing the new Ghost Rider. And there are very few characters in any medium I care less about.
Yeah. I mean, I am super biased, though. Like, I really despise the Bendis era Avengers, and I have read a giant chunks of it, so I cannot at the very least be accused of not giving Bendis a shot. But, you know, I must be in the minority, because he was on Avengers for, I don't know, a decade?
More. Like, he led straight to Hickman, right? So he was on from 2001 to, like, 2012.
Yeah, basically. So,
I don't think I've ever liked a Bendis team book. I mean, I can't stand his writing in general, but his team books in particular, I really, really, really dislike.
Yeah, I mean, early Marvel Bendis did some really cool things. Like, his first 100 or so issues on Ultimate Spider-Man were really good. He obviously created Miles Morales, who is a character who's had many more legs, ironically, actually, than I think, you know, has kind of outgrown Bendis. His Daredevil run, I think, does hold up.
His Daredevil run at all.
I
thought it was Frank Miller's greatest hits.
It is. I mean, I don't know how much Daredevil you have read, but all Daredevil since Frank Miller, except for Mark Waid's run. But even Mark Waid's run is in conversation with the fact that everybody does Frank Miller's greatest hits.
I'm aware, but that point. Means I don't ever need to read Daredevil anymore.
I mean,
right? Like, I don't need this run 30 times. It's
Waid's run is
to, which to bring us, yeah, Wage Run is very good. Which to bring us for full circle is kind of why I like Tickman. I don't need, like, it's also why I love the Morrison run of New X-Men. I don't need to see I don't need Claremont's run the 15th time. And Hickman was at least saying, okay, like, Morrison did something different, and then Marvel are cowards and immediately ran away. And had the worst decade in X-Men history ever by far. So, and then, like, Hickman's like, well, at least I have all these new ideas, and, like, now we're going to tell stories with these new ideas, and then nothing happened.
Yeah. I mean, I think...
We stopped to wait for another event.
I think New X-Men is interesting because it's super ambitious, but the more I went back... In the years since I read New X-Men, I went back and read a lot of older X-Men, and the trick that Morrison pulls off there is actually it's a lot closer to... New X-Men is a lot closer to 80s X-Men than the X-Men runs that immediately... Like, from the Jim... Has a lot more in common with the Dave Cockrum, John Byrne era X-Men than it has with the post-Jim Lee era X-Men.
No, I don't think that's true. No. It's like Scott Lobdell built his entire career on poorly aping Claremont. And like the Fabian Nitschke era is literally just like, it's just them trying to tell the Claremont stories over and over
again. I agree with you that it's trying to tell the Claremont stories, but I feel like Morrison is actually telling stories more like Claremont than the people who were actually trying to tell Claremont stories, if that makes sense. Like the way he introduces ideas, blows them up, rebuilds the universe.
Sure. Like, what he's doing is shaking up the premise and how the metaphor works. He might be structuring stories in a similar way. And like, he's talented enough to like tell stories that feel like X-Men stories with that, but he was also like everyone else just kept hitting the exact same tropes and the exact same metaphors, and Morrison was like, but how about if we completely update and change the metaphors that we're working with here and see how everything else shakes out as a response to that, and then add my own weird drug idea.
I guess what I'm trying to say is that right there is what Claremont did for the first 10 years or so he was on the X-Books. Like, he updated the metaphor. He put his own weird idiosyncratic set of drug metaphors and magic and like, which, like, paganism. It's sex, BDSM, and smoking a lot of pot for Claremont, right? Like, I think that Morrison is more tapping into that same vein in a way that is much more Claremontian than the people who are literally just trying to tell Claremont stories, if that makes sense.
Because
I feel like the high point of Claremont era X-Men and New X-Men have a lot, and they're doing the same kind of cultural, intellectual work with the X-Men franchise. And if you read them in conversation with each other, it's really, really...
Right, but that
powerful, like all good Morrison stories, right?
But yes, like that. telling using similar structures to tell different stories is fine. It's trying to ape structures to tell the same stories I have a problem with. He's not telling the same stories; he's telling totally different stories.
I think we're in agreement at that point. I guess what I'm just trying to say is, I think Morrison
is different in the same way Claremont is different.
Yes. And I think that while Morrison, particularly like at the time, Morrison's work felt like a real fresh break with what the X-Men were and something like brand new, like new X-Men. But actually, if you go back to those late 70s, 80s stories, it's actually not, it's continuing a tradition. It's not creating new things, is continuing a tradition of reinvention that was lost when that tradition of reinvention became crystallized in the 90s.
That's you're just shoving a lot of Claremont into one box.
Sure.
I get that. You're just treating a lot of Claremont as if it were one kind of thing. And like, yes, there is constant reinvention in Claremont, but like sometimes that reinvention, like there's a good chunk of like 5 years where X-Men becomes very samey under Claremont before like Australia.
That's fair.
Like they get back from space, like post burn, right? Like post both Dark of Phoenix. The Brood and Dark Phoenix. And then like they spend a bunch of time doing the same thing. Like they spend the majority of the 80s on repeat. And then like they're like, Claremont gets bored, right? Like he's like, this is successful, but screw it. And then we start getting the weird.
Yeah, I don't think it's much of the 80s. I don't think you're wrong. I mean, I think comic...
It might only be 3 or 4 years, but again, like...
Yeah, I mean, it's 86 is when, like, X-Factor comes out, and that starts...
I don't think X-Factor changes anything. X-Factor is boring.
I think it starts...
And also, mostly not written by Claremont.
No, but X-Factor pulls the original X-Men out of the main... Uncanny.
They weren't in Uncanny. They weren't like, Uncanny.
Cyclops was, right? Wasn't he?
Cyclops had already left.
Had he at that point? Like, my memory, 2 years before that.
I mean, Cyclops had left with Madeline for like a year or two at that point. Cyclops is the only one who really stuck around of the original five. The others were in and out. But like, Cyclops seems to have been the only one he had any long-term interest in besides the team. Even then, he wanted her to be dead, right? So.
Mm. He did. But What's-His-Face didn't... What's his name? What was the editor of Marvel at that time?
I don't remember his stupid name. Shooter? Is that Jim?
Yeah, Jim Shooter, yeah. Didn't want her to be dead. But I think, though, like, series were allowed to ostify a lot more back then. Like, if you look at, like, I mean, almost all of those, like, classic comics runs that we look back on from the 70s and 80s that people say were massively influential, they inspired the Winter Soldier or whatever, a lot of them have a lot of really bad garbagey issues. Like, I mean, this is like Mark Gruwald on Captain America, which has told, honest to goodness, the best Captain America stories ever. There's so much garbage in his runs on Captain America. For like every one good issue, there's like five bad issues. But it doesn't mean that, you know, his take on the character didn't refresh the character, update it, or, you know, do all this amazing stuff. It just means that back then, you know, because runs were much longer and stories were told in a much more like done in one way, that it's going to lead to stagnation. Just like a lot of these classic TV shows from that era. Like people remember the high points, but they don't remember like, you know, LA Law season 6, episode 11, which was the same boring ass law case as every other episode. They remember the woman walking into the open elevator shaft, right? Like, they remember the high points. They don't remember the like long stretches of boredom.
Well, also, much of the 90s was terrible comics.
Almost all, yes. It was,
I don't know.
There was a lot of bad comics in the 90s.
But there were many, 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 many terrible comics. So like, when good comics started happening again regularly, it was a big shift. Like, the 90s were god awful.
Particularly for Marvel. Marvel produced a lot of really bad comics in the 90s.
Oh, yeah. I mean, notoriously bad for them.
And I honestly think Glazer, I think, is more recently revisited, because I know he's still listening to Explain the X-Men, has revisited some of the like, Age of Apocalypse stuff. But I think that the DC big event of that era it have aged better than the Marvel big events of the 90s.
Marvel only had one good big event. The only good big event the entire Marvel 90s, I think, is Age of Apocalypse.
Yeah.
Like, unless you have like
the only one I can even remember.
Oh, there's tons.
Onslaught, the Fallen Covenant, Operation Zero Tolerance.
I mean, those are just X ones alone. There's also the clone.
Oh, Operation Galactic Storm. Thank you for using Operation.
Operation Galactic Storm.
Avengers: The Crossing, which I bet you know what Avengers: The Crossing is. I definitely do.
I vaguely do.
Revealed that Iron Man was a traitor. So the third issue of Avengers. And killed him and replaced him with a teenage version from an alternate universe.
I forgot that happened.
Avengers have spent most of their history being really bad comics.
Yeah, a lot of their history, yeah. But, I mean, the 90s was a nadir of Avengers.
Yeah, but like even like even the 80s, they were just like a C-team 80% of the time of like, wow, look at those Wonder Man stories.
Like, ouch to just, Wonder Man.
Wonder Man is one of my least favorite characters.
I mean, he does suck. Like a C-tier character at best.
I mean, that's the trick, right? Is that theoretically Avengers should have always been like the A team of Marvel, but it like really wasn't. And to be fair to Bendis, he really did reinvent the franchise in a way that
has made it more the MCU.
They allowed the MCU, but to be fair, I mean, not necessarily, right? Because actually, the trick was. The MCU actually doesn't do
what Bendis did, yeah.
But it actually taps into the older stuff, right? Bendis's formula worked in the context of comics, like the comic industry. It's like, let's have the most famous Avengers plus Wolverine and Spider-Man on the Avengers. Let's make Wolverine and Spider-Man Avengers. That sells comics, right?
Yeah,
love Iron Man.
I still don't think the MCU happens without what Bendis rehabilitated by doing that was the Avengers as a brand.
That's right? Fair.
Like it became something like Iron Man could be in a cool comic now. Because like no one gave a shit about Iron Man, right?
Iron Man had not been a particularly actually the real thing that makes Iron Man possible is the Bush years.
A giant complex
of particular cultural moments for Marvel. Yeah.
Either which damn way.
But I think the trick that the MCU does that the comics like really haven't been able to do is like it taps into that older like theme with the Avengers that it's like hard to quantify, but the fact that, you know, they did pick like the most iconic characters and were willing to let them play off each other. Because if you remember New Avengers, like New Avengers has very little in common with any of the, two Whedon movies, Civil War, like, mm-hmm. approach to the Avengers. Like there's no,
yeah, but it doesn't need to thematically, like it just needs to be fun and big. And that's what New Avengers was. It didn't even bother making a whole lot of sense, right? Like they were like, we're not going to pay off stories. It's Bendis. He didn't plot. So like, it was just, here's this big fun idea. Everything, whether it was important or not, felt important and had its tongue firmly in cheek. It was winking at you the whole time. In a way that I don't think Avengers ever did. Like, Bendis's Avengers never felt fully serious. It was always like, come on, Avengers, huh? In a way that the movies are also doing.
Here's the thing. I never felt the tongue in cheekness with Bendis. I actually always felt that Bendis took himself too seriously.
His stupid dialogue pages, which are just him winking at the camera.
But there's a guy who like had Tigra brutally assaulted on pages. Yeah. A woman whose like superpower is basically being a Tigra woman, right? Like brutally assaulted by a supervillain.
Do you think he understood that? Come on.
I self seriousness is always kind of like,
yeah, but I don't feel, I disagree completely. It has to be able to be taken seriously in much the same way Thanos or Loki do, right? Like, everything has to be taken seriously, but, like, it's all in service of the grand adventure. And under that grand adventure, there's that, like, conspiracy. There's always that thing, that big hidden threat that's coming to keep you reading. But, like, here's this grand adventure. Look, these characters you really like are doing this really cool thing. Look. And, like, everything is in the service of that. And anything else is just to build drama for the next big moment. Because it's not to build drama for the story. It's just to build drama for the next moment. And that's why, like, you can do that super serious thing and it doesn't really affect the tone outside of, like, readers who actually give a shit about the characters. Because he's not asking you to give a shit that Tigra got raped. He's asking you to care about what everyone's reaction to it is for the next 2 pages.
Fair.
I don't like Bendis very much.
I think that can probably come across to people who are listening to this that don't either of us particularly like Bendis.
Yeah, but it's an effective way of storytelling. Like, a lot of what media that's successful seems to do well that Hollywood mostly refuses to learn from is they don't tell you everything. They hint at an awful lot of backstory that they're not giving you, and they make it seem like you have to figure things out. Like, there's this lived-in world, and, like, there's other adventures that you're not being told.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely one of the things the MCU does well.
It was one of the secrets to, like, the 90s X-Men cartoon. Which, like, if you watch it as someone who's never seen X-Men, it's just, like, a world of, like, these fully developed characters in this fully developed world, and it's only, like, half explained, and you just sort of figure it out and go. Like, that figure it out and go, it's Star Wars, right? Like, the first Star Wars, like, yeah. A lot of really successful. It hits
so much.
It's just like, there's this world and there's all these things that happen and you're going to get a snippet of it and just take it on face value and run. And the more they try and explain that, the less cool and effective the thing often becomes, hence prequels and sequels issues. But like, the more you keep that sense of like, this is an adventure, we're going to just keep it going, like, the better off you are. Which is an awful long way from slopping Hickman's X-Men, but here we are.
that was wide-ranging. I really wish I'd kept up more with X-Men for the last, like, decade to have interjected, but... You know, maybe I shouldn't have.
Most of the comics we talked about actually didn't come out in the last decade, Will. So
House of X and Powers of X were genuinely some of the coolest comics I've ever read. And then they were like, we're going to tell stories coming out of this. And 90% of those stories were just like...
Drowning Kitty Pride. Oops, sorry.
That was actually a really good book. Didn't make the most sense, but that's like one of the few books that actually did go anywhere and managed to like work. It's just most of them were like, here's an individual story that's completely standalone and sort of hints at things, but like they never really developed a sense of character and they never developed any momentum, so that it felt like we were getting closer to the big issues. It was just here's another piece. Like, you need to string the puzzle along. You can't just give me pieces. Still better than the 12.
The 12? The like miniseries that brought back a bunch of like forgotten 40s heroes?
Oh no. Roy, do you remember the 12?
12. Off the top of my
head. The 12 is this early 2000s. I'm gonna get the year wrong. X-Men story. It was meant to be the ultimate, like ultimate as in final, apocalypse story. X-Men spent like a decade hinting that there were these 12 mutants that were destined to join forces to defeat Apocalypse. Uh-huh. And then they finally told the story and it was the worst, most...
Oh, was that the one how they killed Cyclops right before he comes back for new...
Yes.
Yeah, that's not called the 12. I just Googled. The 12 is a J. Michael Straczynski storyline involving the Timely characters.
Oh, okay.
2007.
The
12.
That's a really fun book. I liked it.
It's called Apocalypse the 12?
It's called Apocalypse the 12.
Okay.
Is it? So it's the second thing when you Google Marvel the 12.
It's the worst X-Men comics that I think have ever existed.
I remember this. I think I did read this contemporaneously because I remember, it was something that was set up like from a one line thing in a Claremont issue in the 90s. Right. And then,
yeah. And then they just kept hinting and hinting and hinting and no one knew where they wanted to go. And eventually it turned out that Apocalypse had planted Cable to exist to take over Cable's body, which we already knew, but then he ended up in Cyclops' body somehow, and Cyclops died. It was just...
Cyclops sacrificed himself to permanently kill Apocalypse, if I remember correct, but of course...
Yeah, it ends up being, like, actively incomprehensible.
Right, and Morrison's able to use this as a retroactive continuity to explain Cyclops' attraction to Emma Frost, right? Right. And the fact that they're, like, he and Jean are on the outs because he came back from the dead. Yep. I'm remembering now. I'm tapping.
It's actually not the worst X-Men I've ever read. I take it back.
No, there's a lot of bad. I mean, have you read?
Well, what's his name? I can't think of worst. I can't think of his name. He wrote around the same time Morrison wrote. He wrote the other X book.
Oh, he wrote.
Juggernaut ends up when Juggernaut ends up a good guy.
Yeah. Chuck Austin.
Chuck Austin is the worst X-Men I've ever read. Chuck Austin is bad.
Yes, that is up there as one of the worst runs of any Marvel comic of all time.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Oof. All right. Moving along to video games, finally.
I was going to say, that was a long move. We may need to... Move through the rest of our list relatively quickly at this rate.
Seems wise. I'm going to quickly re-recommend, and all I'm going to say is, if you have a 3DS, get Radiant Historia Perfect Chronology. If you have any interest in JRPGs, I finished it. It's one of the five best JRPGs I've ever played. Like, it's impossible for me to explain exactly how well done it is. It's perfect in almost every way.
Okay.
I'm also going to... I started Legend of Heroes Trails in the Sky, which Roy has played. Will, did you play it?
I have not.
So Legend of Heroes is a series that currently has, I want to say, the ninth game is coming out in September. It's a trilogy, a duology that's not available in English.
It's a trilogy.
Well,
Trails of the Sky is a trilogy. Then there's duology, not in English.
And then there's another.
A quadology. Quadology. There's four Trails games. Yep.
Trails
of Steel. Cold Steel, rather.
Yep.
Yep.
So I'm starting with at the very beginning. Going to play through this whole giant series. The very first game, the battle system isn't great. The battle is weak, but the world feels amazing, lived in. It does all the excellent lore stuff we just discussed in that comic section. Mm-hmm. The protagonist, Eliza Bright, is damn delightful. She's a little, tiny little force of nature, and it's got some of the best.
Eliza? Isn't it Estelle?
Estelle, you're right. Who's Eliza? Eliza's a character in a different game.
Hamilton, I suppose.
Also Hamilton, yes. All right.
It's definitely Estelle. I was like, wait, Eliza? I mispronounce everything, right. But I'm pretty sure it's...
No, you're right. Estelle Bert. And she's a fantastic character, and it's got some of the best music I've ever heard in a game already.
Music counts for a lot.
Trails does have some of the best music in the entire world.
It's very jazzy, very fun and upbeat. And like the game just is really fun so far. I wish the system weren't letting it down so much, because everything else is very good.
Yeah, I mean, I will prop Legend of Heroes. You can either start from the beginning with Trails, or you can, if a very PS1 era-y JRPG isn't your jam, you can go to the more modern stuff of Trails and Trails in the Sky. Or not Trails of the Sky, excuse me. Trails of Cold Steel, which is where I really fell in love with the series. My wife and I are big fans of it. So, Reen. I love Trails. The fourth one comes out in a couple months. So,
about in a couple months?
Trails is Cold Steel
4. Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Comes out in October, I think.
Yeah. So, I'm hoping to be done with the trilogy by the Sky trilogy by the end of summer. And then I have to decide if I, whether or not I would like to pirate and English translate the Lost Bell Saga.
Well, they're making noises about the PS4 remaster coming into the US. So that's coming in Japan. So I don't know. You can definitely understand Trails of Cold Steel without having played the Crossbell arc, as they say. They really go out of their way to explain to you what goes on in the Crossbell arc, which is one of the strengths and weaknesses of Trails. In fact, if you like George R. R. Martin's writing, which at the beginning of every Song of Ice and Fire novel, he basically gives each POV character a chapter where they explain everything that happened in the previous book. That is also what Trails of Cold Steel does. And all the Trails games do, is they always like really explain at the beginning of each game what happened in the previous game. So you can't miss a beat. Props.
The other game I started is Xenogears, which is many people's favorite game ever. It's a very engaging plot and a very engaging battle system hung on a game that is really, really badly showing its age. Like, textures are murky. Everything is very ugly. Moves are choppy. There's a random battle like every 2 seconds. Put hanging platforms on that ugly, ugly system was not a great idea. The maps are hard to figure out. But the battle system is really fun, and the plot is really engaging, and the characters are really good. Who decided that dialogue should take like so slow to come out of each character's mouth?
But it's a good question. I don't know.
It's a game full of weird design decisions, because like it's a PlayStation 1 game, but there's Super Nintendo games that figured all this stuff out, right? Like, it's not like they had no model to work from. This isn't Dragon Quest 1. They made design decisions that were like, why would you choose to do that? And they wanted to, they decided that was the way to do it, and it's making what should be a completely incredible game, one that I'm a little confused about.
I mean, I had kind of forgotten a lot, but until you brought it back up, I do kind of recall like that the random battle stuff did seem extra intense in Xenogears.
Yeah.
Literally step-step battle.
God forbid
you run.
It is a game that is, even when I played it in 2003, 2004, it felt old. And that was only 4 or 5 years after it came out. So
I don't think that does it. I don't think it's that it feels old, because like again, I just played a DS game. I'm currently playing through Earthbound. Like I'm playing all these old games. It's not that it feels old. It's not like they didn't know better. They actively chose these weird decisions.
Like, yeah, I mean, it's basically a game. I mean, particularly Xenogears is like somebody who got really, really high and watched Neon Genesis Evangelion and decided to make a game heavily inspired by it, but had a half-finished Final Fantasy script that they kind of were stuck on. So
Final Fantasy VIII.
Yeah. No, 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 no.
It actually was. Like, the guy who wrote it thought he was writing Final Fantasy VIII and ended up a different project.
Right.
They were like, this is too weird.
I mean, I thought you meant, like, specifically it was like Final Fantasy VIII as it turned out, because it's nothing like
Final Fantasy VIII. No, it was meant to be Final Fantasy VIII.
But, yeah. So if you like Evangelion, you will definitely like Xenogears. They play in similar theme and trope.
I'm okay with Evangelion.
So
I think it's very ambitious.
Mm-hmm. It is definitely ambitious. You cannot get away from playing. I literally have not played Xenogears in like 17 or 16 years, but
oh, yeah.
The memories have stuck with me of it. You will not step away from that game being like, everything is extremely ambitious. They are clearly trying really, 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 really hard.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't always lead to a very coherent, clear, or satisfying play or storytelling experience. But it is definitely, they're swinging for the rafters, to use a sports metaphor.
It feels almost like they took a look at Dragon Quest and were like, this has done this type of game about as well as it's going to be, about as straightforward and clean as it's going to be. What if we ignored what we learned from that and tried to do the exact opposite? Like, Dragon Quest doesn't care about puzzles or platforming. So let's add puzzles and platforming. Dragon Quest doesn't like wants battles to be quick, clean, and easy. Like how do we like make this as complicated as possible, where you have to like, you have hidden experience on different combos you can use. Like, it's just it's saying, okay, we have learned how to do this thing, let's try and relearn it a totally different way. And that's, I mean, it's impressive that it's as successful as it is.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I was also thinking about it. It was definitely, they had clearly played a lot of SMT games as well. Because well, it's
not a lot. There weren't that many yet.
Right? There was three, I think, when it came out. Two or three.
Nocturne is three, and Nocturne's a PS2 game. So,
there was two plus.
Oh, well, Persona 1 would have definitely been out. I don't know.
No, Persona 1 wasn't out yet. I don't believe.
Persona 1 was out. Yes, almost certainly.
Let me look.
Isn't Persona 1 like 1995?
New
1999
90s 1996 so it was out. The original was out, but the sequels came out the same year. Mm-hmm. Two came out in the same year. But just it's, I don't want to give spoilers for you, Glazer, or for it, but
I don't give a shit.
Anyway, like the killing god and order and all the shit, like
all
SMT shit. So as well, so. They whatever they were on, you know, whatever super illegal Japanese drugs they were taking when they came up with this plot.
Well, what's his name just continues to make games like it, right? Like, this is his interest. What's his name?
Oh, the guy. No, I don't think Xeno Saga. And then what's the current Xeno Blade? Are not. Anywhere near as nuts as Xenogears. Like, particularly Xeno Saga, right? Whatever the current one is a very traditional JRPG. I mean, it shares a lot of, like, some of the same trope space, but it's not as, like, batshit nuts as Xenogears is, as you will find.
Xenogears was submitted as a plot for Final Fantasy VII.
Huh.
Not 8.
I never knew that.
And was judged too dark and complicated.
So it was originally developed in like 1995 then. So
this worked on like everything. His very first game, he did art for Dragon Slayer, which is the very first Legend of Heroes game.
There we go. Anyway, I don't know if I could at this point even prop or slop Xenogears. It just kind of exists as the thing that I experienced. My experience of Xenogears transcends simple propping and slopping.
I think I'm propping it for ambition. But it's an experience. I'm very happy I'm playing Trails in the Sky, which is very straightforward with it. Because, like, if I was playing anything else complicated, it would break my brain. All right. I want to slop M21.
Oof. Why is that? You've been hard on Magic lately.
It's really boring. Like, it's just, you can grab a bunch of white cards and just throw them together. You're not really building decks. You're just building things that you can throw at the opponent fast or try and stop the opponent from throwing things at you fast. It's, I still like it better than Theros Beyond Death, but only just barely. And Theros Beyond Death was with bots. So maybe I do like it less.
Yeah, Theros didn't do much for me. M21 didn't hook me like Ikoria did. And I didn't even actively like the theme of Ikoria, but once you guys got me drafting some, it was really fun. It had a lot of good themes and depth, but M21 both seemed to be focusing on some themes I didn't really care about, and I didn't enjoy the first couple drafts I did, so I kind of wandered off.
It's very turn card sideways. Like, literally, like, find 8-2 drops, a couple things to pump them, and then turn them all sideways. Don't play things above 4 cost. It's really not fun. However, on Friday, which I guess will be when this comes out, Throne of Eldraine is live drafting on Arena.
Like, hey. With people?
Yes, with people. So I'm very excited for that. That was my first set, all of 4 sets ago. But it did not have people draft, so I'm very excited to try it with real human beings. Looking forward to my gingerbread man.
Yeah, I'm excited to play some Throne of Eldraine. Wonder if we can get Oko.
I mean, we can if he's in a pot, right?
Excuse me. I'm not as down on M21 as you are, Glazer, but I definitely see where the point you're coming from. This is the third Modern Age Magic core set I played in, and it is my least favorite of the three. I probably liked M20? M20, yeah. A little bit more than than M19. So, but I still think it's a playable format, but it's definitely not like screaming I want to draft it all the time. Like Arcoria, or I really actually liked Theros too. I just was like not able to draft it as much as I wanted to, but I definitely liked it a lot. So this is probably the worst set of this year, but it's still far from bad. Just not as good as it could be.
Fair enough. Yeah. Talk about your Hearthstone.
Yeah, I've been trying to learn Battlegrounds. I know there's many hardcore gamers who probably will laugh, but I made a goal over the last 2 weeks to make the top 20% of ELO in Battlegrounds, and I did it last night. And I'm pretty excited. So I'm going to try to gain another 1,000 ELO points over the next week. I'm really enjoying it. It is weirdly relaxing to play, but also strategically challenging. So I will continue to prop it. And there was just a new small patch with a couple of minor balance changes and a couple new heroes. So if you haven't played Battlegrounds in a while, I would definitely recommend coming back for it, because the new heroes are pretty fun and the meta is in an all right spot, even if Merlecs are a little too powerful. But there's definitely comps that can beat Murlocs unless they see the nuts, as the students say. So, students, the young people.
The young people. I still haven't tried Battlegrounds at all. I haven't hopped back into Hearthstone since pretty recently after Demon Hunter dropped. So maybe
it's free.
The Battlegrounds stuff is?
Yeah, like every game is free. So like, like it's not Arena. If you do the 100% free, you don't get to choose from 4 heroes. You only get to choose from 2. Okay. But like otherwise you can just sit there and spin all night long if you want.
Oh, I thought I'd have to spend like Arena.
Okay. Nope, it's nothing. Nope, it's not like Arena. You just click go and you can immediately start playing.
Okay, cool. I do need to try that then.
You only got to pay the $10 to get the perks, which is basically unlocking all four hero selection slots. But you don't have to pay the $10 if you don't want to.
Nice.
Yeah.
What do we have left here? I had a slop, but we're rolling on to nearly an hour and a half, so I'm not going to dwell on it. I'm just going to slop the whole concept of double master VIP packs for Magic. $100 for and what is it? Mostly foil booster pack. Pretty cash grabby is maybe the most generous way to say it.
Well, yeah.
Physical cards, shrug.
Yeah.
I would definitely $100. You can just watch the professor's Tatarian Community College's video on on the subject. If you're interested in it, I would just watch that and it explains everything. So pretty succinctly.
Okay. Good night, everybody.